Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at this book of Esther. It's a story told many years ago, told around the same time of Nehemiah and Ezra. And if you're familiar with the time, that was after the Jews had been in Babylon for about 70 years. Some of them have already gone back to Jerusalem. Some of them are involved in the rebuilding of the temple. And yet some people stay back in Babylon. And there are several that we can think of. Certainly Nehemiah was one of them that was still in the city of Babylon, probably in Susa. And so God was continuing to work on both sides, people in Jerusalem, people that stayed back. And this is a story that kind of unfolds. It's kind of interesting because it's not completely unlike other stories that we've seen where people just seem to have kind of risen up almost from nowhere. They've risen up to places of influence, places of power where God was able to use them in a mighty way. Maybe we could think of somebody like Joseph. Didn't something similar happen to him where you know, he was very insignificant. He ended up being a slave and he was in Egypt but eventually he rose up to be second in command. Maybe we think of somebody like Daniel in a very similar situation, that he was just one of the captives in Babylon, which is actually just a previous to this Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, and he was somebody who was just a slave, somebody who was insignificant, and yet God was able to use him and to raise him up to a position. It's kind of interesting as you think about these different types of events in history. You know, with Joseph, if you remember Joseph, what did he say about all of these things happening? Why did it happen? Was God really involved in this at all? But in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20, Joseph said to his brothers, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done in the saving of many lives." And so sometimes things happen and we don't know why they're happening. We don't know why things are coming together. We don't know why events unfold, but certainly in the Jewish mind, it was, hey, God is behind this. And so Joseph was very familiar with this. He saw that very clearly. Well, you know, with Daniel being in Babylon, and you remember as he was there with King Nebuchadnezzar, and he was, you know, King Nebuchadnezzar thought he was the guy in charge, that he had all the rule and all the authority and all the power, and he had some dreams, and Daniel was interpreting. But one of the things that God wanted Nebuchadnezzar to know, even through Daniel, was this, in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 32. At the end there it says, seven times will pass by until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and he gives them to whomever he wishes. Wow, some pretty powerful lessons that we learn about how God is just using people to show and to influence and to lead and to teach some great lessons many, many years ago, but these are things that we could really learn from today. If we look back and say, well, what is the lesson for me? And as we study through Esther, so this series, we're going to spend a few weeks in Esther. So the series is actually called Right on Time. And it's really about God working through this woman and even through her cousin Mordecai and just how things are falling into place. And things aren't just happening by coincidence or happenstance, but God is behind it. Now, you may have read through the book of Esther before, and maybe this week you could probably read through it in about 20 or 25 minutes, about 10 chapters. It's really a story that unfolds. It's a story. It's actually not just a story. It's a story about history. It's something that actually happened. It's not just something that's made up. As a matter of fact, even the Jews today remember this every year, kind of late summer, early fall in a celebration they called Purim. P-U-R-I-M. It's a celebration where they remember this exact event, this exact story, this exact thing in history. But it's not just his story. It's his story. It's God's story. It's God's story of redemption. And surely there's things that we can learn from this, that we can benefit, that we can glean, that can help us in our lives. Now, we can probably have a leadership seminar and we can talk to great length about how leaders are made, the type of things leaders do, and certainly the type of things leaders don't do if you want to be effective, maybe in a corporation or maybe even among a club or even in your own home, things about leadership. And certainly there's a lot of great lessons in Esther about leadership. But it's not really just about leadership of people. It's about how God is working. Because again, we read through the book of Esther and we say, you want to know something? I've read it chapter to chapter all the way through beginning to end. And God's not mentioned anywhere. God's not even mentioned. Now, this is a book that God himself decided he's going to put in the Bible. Right? I believe that the Bible we have today was designed by God. The things that are included were put there because of God. The things that are excluded, you know, maybe some of the other manuscripts and books and history articles, they're not in the Bible because God didn't want them in the Bible. The Bible is the way that God wanted the Bible to be. But more than that, that God wrote the book of Esther, he was behind, it was the inspiration. That's kind of what we would say the Bible clearly says in 2 Timothy 3 verse 16, that all scripture is inspired by God. And all scripture is profitable. It's beneficial for teaching and reproof and correction, training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be equipped for every good work. So God wrote the book of Esther. And you know why God's name is not written? It's not found? It's not even, it's not there in the book. Why? Because God didn't want it there. I mean, if you're writing a book and you want to include your name, you can do it. If you don't want your name in it, leave it out. That's your prerogative because you're the author. So God decided, I'm not putting my name in the book. And you wonder, well, why would, you know, we read all kinds of books in the Bible. There's 66 books, but this is one of two books. I believe the other one they say is Song of Solomon. I've not read through that one to find out if God's not mentioned, but we're learning a little bit more about Song of Solomon on Wednesday nights. Woohoo! But, you know, Song of Solomon, you kind of think, good thing his name's not written in there. It just doesn't really go there very well. But anyway, it's not in the Song of Solomon either. But why is his name not in Esther? Because I think that maybe God wants us to read the book of Esther this way, and we read through it chapter by chapter, and we say, you know, God's name's not in there. We say, well, maybe I should read it again. And we read it again. We say, well, hang on. His name's not in there, but I can see God working. And then we read it a third time. We say, wow, he's working a lot more than I ever thought he was working. And so maybe God's name is not in there because he wants us to see him working. It doesn't have to say God did this, God, you know, provided this, God orchestrated. It doesn't have to say all that. It's just saying God is working. But you want to know something? God is working even sometimes where we say, but I don't see God working in my life. I don't see God's imprint. I don't see God dealing in my, I don't see him orchestrating things in my life. Because let me tell you, there's some things in my life that don't always go well and they don't always work out the way I hope and the way I had planned. And so what do we say? Well, maybe God's not working. Maybe God's just left me alone. Maybe I've done something against God and he's mad at me. But you know, reading through the book of Esther, we see, no, even when things don't go so well, God is up to something. God has not left the story. He's right there in the middle. So we have to have that view of God in our own lives, that sometimes where we think he is so distant, but maybe that's when he's so close, that's when he's working. He works things out according to his will, according to his plan, according to his design. And I think this is what God is going to be showing us and doing for us. He's going to reveal himself through the book of Esther. Sometimes in our life, we think, you know, I want to see God working in my life day by day so that I can know for sure that he is with me and so that I will be benefited and I will be blessed. But quite often when you read, especially through the Old Testament, it doesn't really work that way. God is not really so much concerned about you. God is concerned about everyone. God is concerned about the plan he has, even for the world. Let me give you an example. Like with Abraham. Oh, God said, I will give you many descendants. And Abraham's 100 years old and still working on it. Like for the first one. Right? It just doesn't seem to be working. What is God doing? And God is, I think, really saying, Abraham, it's not all about you. Yeah, I do want to bless the world. I want to bless everyone. Through you, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. You see, Abraham, it's not just about your life and your happiness and about your here and now. So we would say God is not concerned just about today. He is concerned about his eternal plan. And maybe not even for your life and for my life, not even just for years to come, but maybe he's working things out right now for generations to come. That's the way he worked in the Old Testament. So we see God is bigger than our needs and our personal desires and what's happening today. He is bigger than just about the me. He is concerned about his overall plan and how he will bless others. So we're going to see how this begins happening here, even in chapter 1. Chapter 1, it just kind of really starts out, verse 1, it just really starts right into the story without any, background. But we maybe want to get an idea of what's happening here. This was, again, just after the Babylonian Empire. We read about that in Daniel. And now we're coming into the Persian Empire. And it talks about that the king here was in Susa. We're going to look at some verses, but let's just get an idea of where we're at and where we're going with this. This is basically the history of where Nehemiah and Ezra and Esther, all three of them are working together. Again, Ezra and Nehemiah are more working in Jerusalem, and Esther stayed back in Susa in Babylon. But here they are. They've just come out of the Babylonian exile about 70 years. And so this is where they are in terms of time. But when we talk about how massive and how big the kingdom is, it spans vast amounts of the empire. So this man named Xerxes. Now, maybe in some of the older translations, it doesn't say Xerxes. Perhaps Xerxes is more of his title, kind of like we'd say a king or a pharaoh, but maybe it was Xerxes. Or maybe that would have been his Babylonian name, Xerxes. But some of the other translations call him Ahasuerus, which I think is one of the reasons that Jerry did not read from the older. It's kind of harder to pronounce. And actually, I was really hoping that Jerry could have read a little bit further on about all the names of his attendants and the people that are going to counsel him. I'm not even going to try to read those. But, you know, here is this man that has great power. He ruled over 127 provinces. He had a vast empire. So it was just continuing to build and build even beyond what Babylon had. As a matter of fact, it was during these times, people say, that he actually went into and took the power away from Egypt, and now Egypt as well was under his control. So the time King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa, and in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. So he said, we are doing so well, our kingdom is growing, we've got more power, we've got more money, we've got more people, we've got land. He's going to go on talking about the kind of possessions he has, just the vast amounts of wealth and strength and power that he has. And so we see here on a map, maybe we see where Susa is, but the part that's in orange is really the empire that he is over. So it's a very, very vast empire. He's got all the strength that he has, all the strength that he needs. And so what do you do when you have that much power? And you know, there's no point in just having power, not letting anybody know about it. So what you want to do is you want to show it off. And this is what he decides to do. He says, we're going to have a big demonstration. We're just going to have a great feast. We're going to get all the people together. So for 180 days, not 6 months, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and the glory of his majesty. And when all the days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days. So in other words, you have a party for 6 months. And after the party, you know what you need? You just need another party. But look at this party. The king gave a great banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people. For everybody was invited, from the least to the greatest. They were all there. They were all coming here to the capital of Susa. And they were allowed to participate in this grand celebration. And the reason you do this is just to show how rich you are and how popular you are and the power that you have. You just want everybody to know all about you. And this is what he decides to do. He decides to let everybody know who he is. And it's going to end up really not turning out so well. It's because the wine was served in goblets of gold, and each was different than the other. Now, some people say, I've got dishes like that at home, right? It's kind of like, well, it's just a hodgepodge. You know, every garage sale you go to, you pick up another two. That's not what this means. It means this was just, everyone was a masterpiece. Everyone was uniquely and specifically made. And maybe even some of them were made for a specific purpose. It depends what kind of alcohol you want. You know, it's kind of like sometimes you go to a restaurant and they have different color cups depending on what you're drinking. If you have Diet Pop or if you have a Coke or, you know, they have different things so that they can identify what you, but maybe that's the idea. But that he has all kinds of gold goblets. The royal wine was abundant. In other words, there was a lot. It was overflowing. There was enough that everyone could have as much as they could want, desire, and ask for in keeping with the king's liberality. And by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. In other words, sometimes even back then, and it'd be like going to a wedding reception today, and sometimes, you know, they may have wine to have a toast, right? So it's kind of rude. This is etiquette, you know, so maybe a lot of us have never been to a wedding where they actually have wine. But, you know, you don't go and drink all the wine because that's for later, right? And so maybe that's what the king often would do. He'd say, well, now you can drink. You know, now you can drink your wine, or now you can drink your champagne. Now you can drink your beer. Now, you know, so he's just telling people when they can drink, when they're going to toast, you know, what not to drink. You know, let's keep the best till last. Hey, let's not drink too much. He was saying, there's no holes barred. Whatever you want, whenever you want, whatever kind you want, the quantity, the quality, it doesn't matter. Drink whatever you want, as much as you want. This is just a big party where a lot of people are what? Or getting drunk. That's what they do. Say, well, did they do that back then? I thought that was kind of new. Everybody just kind of goes to the bar and gets drunk and acts like a fool. They did that back then. They were pretty good at it, okay? So they go out and get drunk. And so it's just a big party, and each person can participate in whichever way they want. So on the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high, this is at the end of the party. I mean, can you imagine a drinking party going on for 7 days? He was high in spirits, probably an understatement. I mean, he was probably so drunk he couldn't even think straight. He couldn't. Why? You know, he was just completely drunk and completely out of his mind for the most part. So he says, here's a great idea. I'm drunk. All the power guys are here. You know, all the people that I've been trying to impress for so long. And let's not forget, you know, just about my vast empire, because that was important. You know, don't forget we've just overtaken Egypt. And perhaps in his mind, he's even now thinking, we are next going to Greece. Yes, we can do this because we are the nation. So this is an idea. So he commanded the seven eunuchs to bring to him. So the dot, dot, dot is all the people that we decided not to try to pronounce their names. They're going to bring before him Queen Vashti. This is the royal woman. I mean, this is, I don't know, maybe he had more than one wife, but she is the best that he has. This is the woman he loved the most, or at least she looked the best. So Queen Vashti, she's going to come wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the nobles, for she was lovely to look at. So now there's a great idea. Let's bring the queen. This is going to be great. A man with this much power, and he's got a beautiful wife. Of course he does. That's kind of what you do when you have that much power, right? You can take or get whoever you want. A beautiful wife. So let's invite her in. Because, hey, why not? We're all a bunch of guys. We find out that Queen Vashti actually had her own party for the women. They were somewhere else. It's not like the women were here. This is just a guy's party. I don't know if you've ever been to just a guy's party. I'm guessing the women haven't. But, you know, if it's just a guy's party, you know, they're not really following God, right? You can imagine the kind of stuff they're thinking about and the stuff they're talking about, even the stuff they're doing. I mean, guy parties, when they're drunk, they're crude pigs. That's just the way it is. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. Guy party, let's bring Queen Vashti in because we're going to show her off. Sounds like a good idea. It's not going to be a good idea for Queen Vashti, I can guarantee you that. It's not going to be good. So actually, this is what she decides in the next verse. Verse 12. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Now, this is not a good day for the king, right? He thinks he has all the power in the world, and he asks his wife to come, and she says no. That's not good. I mean, think about, he's embarrassed. He has shame. And so for the rest of the chapter, they decide to get together. Well, what are we going to do about this? This is a big problem. And here's the problem that a lot of people have when it comes to others coming and saying, well, you know, you've embarrassed me, or you've done something against me, or you've made me feel foolish, or you've humiliated me before my friends or my family, or there's something that you've done, you've attacked my position, and now it's to do with, you know, how I feel about, you know, my dignity, and, you know, the person I thought I was, maybe I'm not, you know. So a lot of things are happening. And it's not just him, it's all his drunken buddies. They're thinking the same thing. Because now the king's going to say, well, what are we going to do? What does the law say about this? And you find out nobody really cares about what the law says. They say, let's make our own law. This is what we need to do. And it's interesting as the story unfolds that what are these people really, really concerned about? Well, let me tell you something, king. If you don't do something about your wife, next thing you know, my wife's going to be doing the same thing. And that's not going to be good. So we need to do something. We need to do something here. We need to stand up. We need to issue a decree. The queen is going to be banished. That no longer is she going to be allowed in the king's presence. She's going to be demoted. Now, I don't know, maybe she's going to become a servant. You know, maybe she's just going to be kicked out of the palace and she's going to have to go back to her home or go back to her family, or maybe she's going to live on the street. But she's no longer allowed in the king's presence. So all of this is unfolding. They put it into law. And they're saying, we don't want our wives. We're going to make her a public spectacle. We're going to humiliate her. You know why we're going to do that? So that all the women in the empire, don't know how to treat their husbands. As a matter of fact, let's make a law. Let's make a law. Verse 19. This comes from the king's anger. It comes from the people that he was with as he was asking them, well, what should we done? What should we do? Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. And so also let the king give her a royal position to someone else who is better than she. And so they decided to do that, and then it went on to say this. Verse 21, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Merkham proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom. That's just saying he sent the mail out. He sent this decree. There's a new law. We want everyone to know. To each province in its own script and to each people in its own language. We don't want anyone to misunderstand what we're talking about, because we're going to make an important law here that everyone's going to know about and everyone's going to follow. Proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler of his own household. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't work out very well, does it? I mean, when you make a law to say, women, you submit to your husbands, when you make a law and say, you must do this, it doesn't work out very well. Perhaps you're a man here today and you said, yeah, I've tried that, right? I've told her, here's a law, you've got to do this. And so it doesn't work out when people are commanded by their husbands to say, this is what must be done. Because what does that cause? That causes a rebellion. That causes a resistance, right? So it's kind of interesting, even when we talk about these kind of relationships, by the time we get to the New Testament, it's pretty clear that a man is to love his wife, and he's to be sacrificial for his wife, and he is to put his wife even above himself. And then what is his wife to do? Then she would respect and honor, and she would obey her husband, not because she's commanded to, but because he is acting like Christ, and she says, I want to act like Christ. So the Bible tells us what we need to do, but it's not because it's forced upon you. It's because this is what you want to do because you're a Christian. This is what you want to do because you love God. And this is what you want to do because you love your spouse. So both the husbands and wives have responsibilities, and they have different roles, but it's because of a heart decision, not based on some law that has been made. And so we see the problem in the kingdom, that when people do foolish things, when people think they have lots of power, when people even get to the point where they can't think straight because they've had so much alcohol, that things don't turn out very well. And the kingdom ends up falling apart. And so now Queen Vashti is set aside. But this is an important chapter, because if we had started at chapter 2, you'd say, well, how in the world did Esther ever become a queen? She's a Hebrew. She's an Israelite. And she's going to become a queen in Persia. It doesn't make sense. Chapter 1 is just saying God is allowing things to happen in the life of this king and in the life of the city so that other things can happen that are going to work out for the good of not only the people of God, but for the good of all people. So the story is going to unfold of what happens. But it's interesting that Xerxes thought he was all powerful, and he decided to rule with an iron fist. On the other hand, we know that God loves us, don't we? So how does God bring us to himself? Well, he does it by showing love. He doesn't show it in his pride. He shows it in his humility. He doesn't show us yelling at us from heaven. He came to earth. He doesn't show us by having a great, powerful position in the world, but Jesus came and lived as a very simple man. He came to live as a servant. So the way we live and the way we love and the way we interact with people, and it even reflects our relationship with God, it's not like a great king over such a vast empire. It's like the King of Kings. Oh yes, he was over all the world. He owns the world. He created the world. He sustains the world. But he came in a very simple way to love. He came in humility. He came in service. He came to sacrifice. This is what God is calling us to do. To be those kinds of people that can lead, that can have an influence, that can make a difference, that for the sake of the kingdom of God will be like Jesus and not be like Xerxes. Today, as always, we give an invitation to say, if you want Jesus to transform your life today, to become new, to give up all the power that you think you have, maybe you do have it, maybe it's just all in your imagination. All the influence that you're trying to work things out for your benefit and for your pleasure and for your good, to say, I'm going to give all of that up today. And I'm going to let God work in my life so that I can live for Him and I can live beyond myself. This is what Esther's going to have to do too. She's going to have to make some hard decisions. This is what God is calling us to make a decision. Today, if you want to follow Him, if you want to be baptized into Christ, so that you can begin this life anew, a life with Jesus, putting Him first, number one in your life. Or if we can encourage you, pray with you, let's stand together. We'll sing a song and let us know how we can help you today.